pressure of the heavy, corrosive gas. Columbia had been experimenting with copper barriers, but abandoned them late in 1942 in favor of nickel, the only common metal that resisted hexafluoride corrosion. Compressed nickel powder made a suitably rugged but insufficiently fine-poured barrier material. Electro-deposited nickel mesh made a suitably fine-poured but insufficiently rugged alternative. A self-educated Anglo-American interior decorator, Edward Norris, had devised the electro-deposited mesh originally for a new kind of paint sprayer he invented. He joined the Columbia Project in 1941 and worked with chemist Edward Adler, a young Urey protege, to adapt his invention to gaseous diffusion. The resulting Norris-Adler barrier, in its nickel incarnation, seemed in January 1943 to be improvable eventually to production quality, whereupon Columbia began installing a pilot plant in the basement of Schemmerhorn Laboratory, and Groves authorized full-scale barrier production. The Hudaya Hershey Corporation took on that assignment on April 1st, the day the Gates began operating at Oak Ridge, planning a new factory for the purpose in Decatur, Illinois. Suitable barrier material was the worst but not the only problem Columbia studied and Groves engineered. Hex attacked organic materials ferociously. Not a speck of grease could be allowed to ooze into the gas stream anywhere along the miles and miles of pipes and pumps and barriers. Pump seals, therefore, had to be devised that were both gas-tight and greaseless, a puzzle no one had ever solved before that required the development of new kinds of plastics. The seal material that eventually served at Oak Ridge came into its own after the war under the brand name Teflon. A single pinhole leak anywhere in the miles of pipes would confound the entire system. Alfred O'Neill developed portable mass spectrometers to serve as subtle leak detectors, since pipes of solid nickel would exhaust the entire U.S. production of that valuable resource. Groves found a company willing to nickel plate all the pipe interiors, a difficult new process accomplished by filling the pipes themselves with plating solution and rotating them as the plating current did its work. The plant that would hold thousands of diffusion tanks, the largest of them 1,000-gallon capacity, would be necessarily monumental, four stories high, almost half a mile long in the shape of a U, a fifth of a mile wide, 42.6 acres under roof, some 2 million square feet, more than twice the total ground area of Y-12's Alpha and Beta buildings. K-25, as the gaseous diffusion complex was designated, needed more than a narrow ridge valley. The building and operating contractors, Kellex and Union Carbide, found a relatively flat site along the Clinch River at the southwestern end of the reservation. The first surveying for the coal-fired power plant needed to run the factory began on May 31, 1943. Rather than designing and setting thousands of different columns for footings, the construction contractors leveled and compacted the entire K-25 foundation area, plowing, drying, and moving in the process nearly 100,000 cubic yards of red clay. That took months. The first concrete, 200,000 cubic yards, was not poured until October 21st. By then, the continuing failure to develop an adequate barrier material had led Groves to decide to lop off the unfinished plant's upper stages and limit its enrichment potential to less than 50% U-235. It would have been capable of taking natural uranium all the way to pure U-235 with its full complement of diffusers, and to use this enriched material to feed the beta calutrons at Y-12. Kellex succeeded in devising a promising new barrier material in the autumn of 1943 that combined the best features of the Norris-Adler barrier and the compressed nickel powder barrier. The problem, then, was what to do about the Hudaya Hershey plant under construction in Decatur, which was designed to produce Norris-Adler. Should it be stripped and re-equipped to manufacture the new barrier at the price of some delay in starting up K-25? Or should the several barrier development teams make a final concerted effort to improve Norris-Adler to production quality? Over these significant questions, Groves and Harold Urey violently clashed. Kellex wanted to strip the Houdai Hershey plant and convert it, preferring delay to the risk of failure. Urey thought abandoning the Norris Adler barrier would mean foregoing the production of U-235 by gaseous diffusion in time to shorten the war, in which case he saw no reason to continue building K-25. Its high priority, he argued, would even hinder the war effort by displacing more immediately useful production. Groves decided to submit the dispute to an unusual review committee, the experts who had worked on gaseous diffusion in England. With the renewal of interchange between the British and American atomic bomb programs that autumn, the British had arranged to send a delegation to work in America. Led by Wallace Akers of ICI, the group included Franz Simon and Rudolf Peierls. It met with both sides, Kellex and Columbia, on December 22nd, and then settled in to review American progress. The participants reconvened early in January 1944. The new barrier, the British concluded, would probably be superior eventually to the Norris Adler. But they thought the months of research on the Norris Adler must count decisively in its favor if time was of the essence. The new barrier had been manufactured so far only by hand in small batches. Yet K-25 would require acres of it to fill the planned 2,892 stages of the diffusion plant's cascade. Then Kellex set a trap. It proposed to produce the new barrier by hand by piecework, thousands of workers each duplicating the simple laboratory process Kellex had initially devised, and claimed that by doing so, it could match or beat the Norris Adler production schedule. When the British had recovered from their surprise at the novelty of the proposal, they signaled their preference for the new barrier by agreeing that if production was possible, it ought to be pursued. That agreement sprang the trap. With the British implicitly committed, the American engineers revealed that they could only manufacture the new barrier by stripping the Houdai Hershey plant and foregoing Norris Adler production entirely. Groves, in any case, had already decided, the day before the January meeting, to switch over to the new barrier. The British review then simply ratified his decision. By changing barriers rather than abandoning gaseous diffusion, he confirmed what many Manhattan Project scientists had not yet realized, that the commitment of the United States to nuclear weapons development had enlarged from the seemingly urgent but narrow goal of beating the Germans to the bomb. Building a gaseous diffusion plant that would interfere with conventional war production would eventually cost $500 million, but would almost certainly not contribute significantly to shortening the war, meant that nuclear weapons were thenceforth to be counted a permanent addition to the U.S. arsenal. Urey saw the point and withdrew. From that time forward, write his colleague biographers, his energies were directed to the control of atomic energy, not its applications. 12 days after Enrico Fermi proved the chain reaction in Chicago on December 2, 1942, Groves had assembled a list of criteria for a plutonium production area and definitely and finally ruled out Tennessee. The Clinton site was not far from Knoxville, he comments, and while I felt that the possibility of serious danger was small, we could not be absolutely sure. No one knew what might happen, if anything, when a chain reaction was attempted in a large reactor. If, because of some unknown and unanticipated factor, a reactor were to explode and throw great quantities of highly radioactive materials into the atmosphere when the wind was blowing toward Knoxville, the loss of life and the damage to health in the area might be catastrophic. Such an accident might wipe out all semblance of security in the project, Groves could imagine, and it might render the electromagnetic and gaseous diffusion plants inoperable. Better to site plutonium production somewhere far away. The production piles needed plentiful electricity and water for blowing and cooling the helium that was planned to cool them. For safety, they needed space. Those criteria suggested the great river systems of the far west, particularly the Columbia River Basin. Groves sent out an officer who would administer the plutonium reservation along with the civilian engineer who would supervise construction for DuPont. Besides picking the site, he wanted the two men to get used to working together. They did, agreeing on a promising location in south-central Washington state, and arrived back in Groves' office on New Year's Eve to report. The general received a real estate appraisal on January 21, 1943. By then, he had already personally walked the ground. Eastward of the Cascade Range, 20 air miles east of the city of Yakima, the blue, cold, fast-running Columbia River bends east, then northeast, abruptly 90 degrees southeast, and finally due south, through a flat, arid scrubland on its last excursion toward the continental interior, before it makes its great bend below Pasco to course directly westward 250 miles to the sea. Even that far inland, the river is wide and deep and veined in season with salmon, but the sandy plain surrounding wins little of the river's water, and the barrier of the Cascades denies it more than 6 inches a year of rain. The site Groves' representatives discovered, and Groves acquired at the end of January at a cost of about $5.1 million, was contained within the eastward excursion of the Columbia, some 500,000 acres, about 780 square miles, devoted primarily to sheep grazing, but varied with a few irrigated orchards and vineyards and a farm or two thriving in wartime on irrigated crops of peppermint. Temperatures ranged from a maximum of 114 degrees in the long, dry summers to rare negative 27-degree winter lows. Roads were sparse on the roughly circular 30-mile tract. A Union Pacific Railroad line crossed one corner. A double electric power line of 230 kilovolts traversed the northwest sector on its way from Grand Coulee Dam to Bonneville Dam. Gable Mountain, an isolated basalt outcropping that rose 500 feet above the sedimentary plain a few miles southwest of the 90-degree river bend, divided the riverside land at the bend from the interior. Midway down the tract, where a ferry crossed the Columbia, a half-abandoned riverside village, population about 100, supplied a base of buildings and gave the Hanford Engineer Works its name. Groves could hardly build Hanford until he knew more about the plant that would go there. It was clear that he would need enormous quantities of concrete to shield the production piles and chemical processing buildings. His Hanford engineer searched out accessible beds of gravel and aggregate to quarry. An accident might release radioactivity into the air. That called for thorough meteorological work. The river water needed study. So did the river's valuable salmon to see how they would take to mild doses of transient radioactivity from pile discharge flow. Roads had to be paved, power sources tapped, hutments and barracks built for tens of thousands of construction workers. What had come up once again for discussion early in 1943 was how the plutonium production piles, the DuPont engineers were beginning to call them reactors, should be cooled. Crawford Greenwald, in charge of plutonium production for DuPont, continued to plan for helium cooling because the noble gas had no absorption cross-section at all for neutrons. But it would need to be pumped through the piles under high pressure. That would require large, powerful compressors. Greenwald was not at all sure he had time to build. Enormous steel tanks would be needed to contain the gas. They would have to allow access to the pile but still remain airtight, a formidable challenge to engineer or even simply to weld. Eugene Wigner came to the project's rescue. Fermi had found K4CP1 higher than he expected. The Stagg Field pile had been assembled largely from uranium oxide. Its graphite had varied in quality, improving along the way. A production pile of pure uranium metal and high-quality graphite would find K higher yet, high enough, Wigner calculated, to make water cooling practical. Wigner's team designed a 28-by-36-foot graphite cylinder lying on its side and penetrated through its entire length horizontally by more than 1,000 aluminum tubes. 200 tons of uranium slugs the size of rolls of quarters would fill these tubes. Chain reacting within 1,200 tons of graphite, the uranium would generate 250,000 kilowatts of heat. cooling water pumped through the aluminum tubes around the uranium slugs at the rate of 75,000 gallons per minute would dissipate that heat. The slugs would not go naked into the torrent. Wegener intended that they also should be separately sheathed in aluminum, canned. When they had burned long enough, 100 days, to transmute about one atom in every 4,000 into plutonium, the irradiated slugs could be pushed back out of the pile simply by loading fresh slugs in at the front. The hot slugs would fall into a deep pool of pure water that would safely confine their intense but short-lived fission product radioactivity. After 60 days, they could be fished out and carted off for chemical separation. The Wegener design was elegantly simple. Greenwalt saw engineering problems, in particular the question whether corrosion of the aluminum tubes would block the flow of cooling water, and studied helium and water side by side until the middle of February. Corrosion studies were promising. With water of high purity, writes Arthur Compton, the evidence indicated that no serious difficulties from this source should arise. Greenwalt opted then for water cooling. Wegener, whom Leo Szilard calls the conscience of the project from its early beginnings to its very end, who worried constantly about German progress, wondered angrily why it had taken DuPont 3 months to see the value of a system he and his group had judged superior in the summer of 1942. With that basic decision, construction could begin at Hanford. Three production piles would go up at 6-mile intervals along the Columbia River, two upstream and one downstream of its 90-degree bend. 10 miles south, screened behind Gable Mountain, DuPont would build four chemical separation plants paired at two sites. The former town of Hanford would become a central construction camp, serving all five construction areas. The work proceeded slowly, dogged by recruiting problems. The nation at war had moved beyond full employment to severe labor shortages, and men and women willing to camp out on godforsaken scrubland far from any major city were hard to find. Frequent sandstorms plagued the area, writes Leona Woods, now Leona Marshall, after marrying fellow physicist John Marshall of Fermi's staff. Local storms were caused by tearing up the desert floor for roads, and construction sites were suffocating. Wind-blown sand covered faces, hair, and hands, and got into eyes and teeth. After each storm, the number of people quitting might be as much as twice the average. When the storms were at their worst, buses and other traffic came to a stop until the roads were visible through the gray-black clouds of dust. Stoics who stayed on called the dust termination powder. "The most essential thing to bring with you is a padlock," a project recruiting pamphlet ominously announced. "The next important things are towels, coat hangers, and a thermos bottle. Don't bring cameras or guns." Hanford, says Marshall, was a tough town. There was nothing to do after work except fight, with the result that occasionally bodies were found in garbage cans the next morning. DuPont built saloons with windows hinged for easy tear gas lobbing. Eventually, some 5,000 construction workers struggled in the desert dust, and DuPont built more than 200 barracks to house them. Meat rationing stopped at the edge of the reservation. There were no meatless Tuesdays in the vast Hanford mess halls, a significant enticement for recruiting. The gray coyotes of the region fed sleek in turn on rabbits killed by cars and trucks driving the new reservation roads. By August 1943, work had begun on the water treatment plants for the three piles, capacity sufficient to supply a city of 1 million people. DuPont released pile design drawings in Wilmington, Delaware, on October 4th, and the company's engineers staked out the first pile, 100B, beside the Columbia on October 10th. After excavating, reports an official history, work gangs began to lay the first of 390 tons of structural steel, 17,400 cubic yards of concrete, 50,000 concrete blocks, and 71,000 concrete bricks that went into the pile buildings. Starting with the foundations for the pile and the deep water basins behind it where the irradiated slugs would be collected after discharge, the work crews were well above ground by the end of the year. The 40-foot windowless concrete monolith they were building was hollow, however. Installation of B pile would not begin until February 1944. There was a large change of scale from the Chicago to the Hanford piles, Laura Fermi remarks. As Fermi would have put it, they were different animals. So also were Ernest Lawrence's behemoth mass spectrometers and John Dunning's gaseous diffusion factory with its 5 million barrier tubes. The mighty scale of the works at Clinton and Hanford is a measure of the desperation of the United States to protect itself from the most serious potential threat to its sovereignty it had yet confronted, even though that threat of a German atomic bomb proved to be an image in a darkened mirror. It is also a measure of the sheer recalcitrance of heavy metal isotopes. Niels Bohr had insisted in 1939 that U-235 could be separated from U-238 only by turning the country into a gigantic factory. Years later, writes Edward Teller, when Bohr came to Los Alamos, I was prepared to say, you see, but before I could open my mouth, he said, you see, I told you it couldn't be done without turning the whole country into a factory. You have done just that. The monumental scale reveals another desperation as well. How ambitiously the nation was moving to claim the prize, and to deny it to others, even to the British, until Winston Churchill turned Franklin Roosevelt's head at the conference in Quebec in August 1943, where Operation Overlord, the 1944 invasion of Europe across the beaches of Normandy, was planned. Before then, in June, Groves had demonstrated this last desperation at its most overweening. He proposed to the Military Policy Committee that the United States attempt to acquire total control of all the world's known supplies of uranium ore. When the Union Minière refused to reopen its flooded Chincolobwe mine in the Belgian Congo, Groves had to turn to the British, who owned a significant minority interest in the Belgian firm, for help. After Quebec, the partnership evolved into an agreement between the two nations known as the Combined Development Trust to search out world supplies. That uranium is common in the crust of the earth to the extent of millions of tons, Groves may not have known. In 1943, when the element in useful concentrations was thought to be rare, the general, acting on behalf of the nation to which he gave unquestioning devotion, exercised himself to hoard for his country's exclusive use every last pound. He might as well have tried to hoard the sea. Work toward an atomic bomb had begun in the USSR in 1939. A 36-year-old nuclear physicist, Igor Kurchatov, the head of a major laboratory since his late 20s, alerted his government then to the possible military significance of nuclear fission. Kurchatov suspected that fission research might be underway already in Nazi Germany. Soviet physicists realized in 1940 that the United States must also be pursuing a program when the names of prominent physicists, chemists, metallurgists, and mathematicians disappeared from international journals. Secrecy itself gave the secret away. The German invasion of the USSR in June 1941 temporarily ended what had hardly been begun. The advance of the enemy turned everyone's thoughts and energies to one single job, writes academician Igor Golovin, a colleague of Kurchatov and his biographer, to halt the invasion. Laboratories were deserted, equipment, instruments, and books were packed up, and valuable records shipped east for safety. The invasion rearranged research priorities. Radar now took first place, naval mine detection second, atomic bombs a poor third. Kurchatov moved to Kazan, 400 miles east of Moscow, beyond Gorky, to study defenses against naval mines. In Kazan at the end of 1941, he heard from George Flidoff, one of the two young physicists in his Moscow laboratory who had discovered the spontaneous fission of uranium in 1940 and reported their discovery in a cable to the Physical Review. Flidoff had attended an international meeting of scientists in Moscow in October and heard Peter Kapitsa, Ernest Rutherford's protege, when asked what scientists could do to help the war effort, respond in part. In recent years, a new possibility, nuclear energy, has been discovered. Theoretical calculations show that if a contemporary bomb can, for example, destroy a whole city block, an atomic bomb, even of small dimensions, if it can be realized, can easily annihilate a great capital city having a few million inhabitants. Thus recalled to their earlier work, Flidov challenged Korchatov, as he had already in a similar letter challenged the State Defense Committee, that no time must be lost in making a uranium bomb. The first requirement was fast neutron research, he wrote. The Maud report had only just made that necessity clear to the United States. Korchatov disagreed. Research toward a uranium weapon seemed too far removed from the immediate necessities of war. But the Soviet government, in the meantime, had assembled an advisory committee that included Kapitsa and the senior academician Abram Jaffe, Korchatov's mentor. The committee endorsed atomic bomb research and recommended Korchatov to head it. Somewhat reluctantly, he accepted. So it was that from early 1943 on, writes his colleague A.P. Alexandrov, work on this difficult problem was resumed in Moscow under the leadership of Igor Korchatov. Nuclear scientists were recalled from the front, from industry, from the research institutes which had been evacuated to the rear. Auxiliary work began in many places. Auxiliary work included building a cyclotron. Korchatov moved his institute out of the Soviet capital to an abandoned farm near the Moscow River in the summer of 1943. An artillery range nearby offered an area for explosives testing. Laboratory number 2 would be the Soviet Union's Los Alamos. By January 1944, Korchatov had assembled a staff of only about 20 scientists and 30 support personnel. Even so, writes Herbert York, they did experiments and made theoretical calculations concerning the reactions involved in both nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors. They began work designed to lead to the production of suitably pure uranium and graphite, and they studied various possible means for the separation of uranium isotopes. But the Soviet bear was not yet fully aroused. The kind of man that any employer would have fired as a troublemaker. Thus, Leslie Groves described Leo Szilard in an off-the-record post-war interview, as if the general had arrived first at fission development and Szilard had only been a hireling. Groves seems to have attributed Szilard's brashness to the fact that he was a Jew. Upon Groves' appointment to the Manhattan Project, he almost immediately judged Szilard a menace. They proceeded to fight out their profound disagreements hand-to-hand. The heart of the matter was compartmentalization. Alice Kimball Smith, the historian of the atomic scientists whose husband Cyril was an associate division leader in charge of metallurgy at Los Alamos, defines the background of the conflict. If the project could have been run on ideas alone, says Wigner, no one but Szilard would have been needed. Szilard's more staid scientific colleagues sometimes had trouble adjusting to his mercurial passage from one solution to another. His army associates were horrified. And to make matters worse, Szilard freely indulged in what he once identified as his favorite hobby, baiting brass hats. General Groves, in particular, had been outraged by Szilard's unabashed view that Army compartmentalization rules, which forbade discussion of lines of research that did not immediately impinge on each other, should be ignored in the interests of completing the bomb. The issue for Szilard was openness within the project to facilitate its work. "There is no way of telling beforehand," he wrote in a 1944 discussion of the problem, "what man is likely to discover and invent a new method which will make the old methods obsolete." The issue for Groves, to the contrary, was security. At first, Szilard bent the rules and Groves threatened him. In late October 1942, while Fermi moved toward building CP-1, Szilard apparently badgered the DuPont engineers who arrived in Chicago to take over pile design. Arthur Compton saw this activity as obstructive, but not necessarily subversive. On October 26th, he wired Groves that he had given Szilard 2 days to remove base of operations to New York, Action based on efficient operation of organization, not on reliability. Anticipate probable resignation. Compton did not know this man. Szilard would not resign, for the simple reason that he believed he was needed to help beat Germany to the bomb. Compton proposed surveillance. Suggest Army follow his motions, but no drastic action now. 2 days later, Compton hurriedly wired Groves to desist. Szilard's situation stabilized, with him remaining Chicago, out of contact with engineers. Suggest you not act without further consultation, Conant and myself. Groves had prepared drastic action indeed. On the stationery of the Office of the Chief of Engineers, over a signature block reserved for the Secretary of War, he had drafted a letter to the U.S. Attorney General calling Leo Szilard an enemy alien and proposing that he be interned for the duration of the war. Compton's telegram forestalled an ugly arrest, and the letter was never signed or sent. But the incident raised the issue of Szilard's loyalty and prejudiced Groves implacably against him. Szilard responded forthrightly. He assembled a large collection of documents from the 1939-40 period, demonstrating his part in carrying the news of fission to Franklin Roosevelt and, pointedly, his efforts to enforce voluntary secrecy among physicists in the United States, Britain, and France. Compton, waffling, sent the documents to Groves in mid-November with an implicit endorsement of Szilard's stand. The first Groves-Szilard confrontation thus ended in stalemate. Szilard saw how much raw power Groves commanded. Groves learned how deep were Szilard's roots in the evolution of atomic energy research, and perhaps also that men he considered vital to the project, Fermi, Teller, Wigner, were Szilard colleagues of long standing and would have to be taken into account. As political dissidents have done in the Soviet Union, Szilard embarked next on a careful campaign to negotiate changes by insisting meticulously on the enforcement of his legal rights. His opening sally came December 4th, 2 days after Fermi proved the chain reaction. In a quiet memorandum to Arthur Compton, he noted that the official responsible for handling NDRC patents had requested patent applications for inventions relating to the chain reaction. That raised the question, Szilard wrote, of how to deal with inventions made and disclosed before we had the benefit of the financial support of the government. He and Fermi would be glad to file a joint application, but only if they could be sure they retained their rights to their earlier separate inventions. The memorandum continues in this straightforward style until its final paragraph, which throws down the gauntlet. My present request clearly represents a change of my attitude with respect to patents on the uranium work, and I would appreciate an opportunity to explain to you, and also to the government agency which may be involved, my reasons for it. Previously, Szilard had believed that he would have equal voice in fission development. Since he had now been compartmentalized, his freedom of speech restrained, his loyalty challenged, he was prepared to actuate the only leverage at hand, his legal right to his inventions. Compton sent Szilard's request to Lyman Briggs, whose responsibilities within the OSRD included patent matters. Briggs thought the Army ought to handle it. Szilard waited until the end of December, heard nothing, and advanced further into the field. In a second memorandum, he told Compton he wanted to apply for a patent on the basic inventions which underlie our work on the chain reaction on unseparated uranium, which were made before government support for this research was forthcoming. The patent could be registered in his name alone or jointly with Fermi. He would be willing to assign this patent at this time to the government for such financial compensation as may be deemed fair and equitable. The memorandum mentions no amount. According to Army security files, Szilard asked for $750,000. But the issue was not compensation. The issue was representation. I wish to take this opportunity to mention that the question of patents was discussed by those who were concerned in 1939 and 1940. At that time, it was proposed by the scientists that a government corporation should be formed which would look after the development of this field and be the recipient of the patents. It was assumed that the scientists would have adequate representation within this government-owned corporation. In the absence of such government-owned corporation in which the scientists can exert their influence on the use of funds, I do not now propose to assign to the government, without equitable compensation, patents covering the basic invention. Burdened by Manhattan Project security, with DuPont taking over plutonium production and the Army moving hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of earth in unprecedented construction, Leo Szilard was advancing single-handedly to attempt to extricate the process of decision from governmental restraints and to return it to the hands of the atomic scientists. Compton understood the extent of the challenge. He sent Szilard's two memoranda directly to Conant, whose office received them on January 11, 1943. Szilard's case is perhaps unique, Compton wrote the NDRC chairman, in that for a number of years, the development of this project has continuously occupied his primary attention. There is no doubt that he is among the few to whom the United States government can look for establishing basic claims for invention. The matter is thus one of real importance to our government. Before Washington could respond, Szilard had to fight off a harassing attack from the flank. It strengthened his resolve. He discovered that a French patent, filed originally by Frédéric Joliot's group, had been published in Australia, and he and Fermi had missed the deadline for filing challenges. Some of their claims overlapped the French work. "This is, I am afraid, an irreparable loss," he told Compton. He had now started writing down his own inventions, he said, and hoped to file a number of patents in the near future. Until he had done so, he wanted to be removed from the payroll of the University of Chicago to avoid legal complications. In the meantime, he would toil on once again as a free volunteer. "It would not be my intention to interrupt or slow down the work which I am doing in the laboratory at present." Conant bumped Compton's letter up to Bush, who answered it personally and to the point, with Yankee canniness. "Inventions scientists made after joining the project belong to the project," Bush told Compton. Unless Szilard had disclosed his previous inventions to the University of Chicago at the time of his employment, he had only a very short leg to stand on, if any at all. Genially, the OSRD director outlined the proper legal procedure for secret patent filings and then kicked at the leg Szilard had left. "It is my understanding that none of this procedure has been gone through with in the case of Dr. Szilard." Bush either did not understand or chose to misunderstand Szilard's idea of an autonomous organization of scientists to guide nuclear energy development. "I gather that Dr. Szilard is particularly anxious that the proceedings arising from his early activity in invention in this field, if such eventuate, should in some way become available for the furtherance of scientific research." He thought that was admirable, but he also thought it had nothing to do with the government, nor did he intend that it should. By the time Bush's letter reached Compton, the MetLab director had gone another round with Szilard. Szilard asked for a raise, based upon the value to the project of his inventions. Compton took the position that Szilard had signed over all his rights to his inventions to the government for as long as he was in the government's employ. Szilard would not sign a renewal contract under those terms. Trying to keep him aboard, Compton proposed raising his salary from $550 to $1,000 a month on the basis that the higher level was comparable with the other original sponsors of this project, Messrs. Fermi and Wigner. That might have been acceptable to Szilard, since it tacitly acknowledged the special worth of the three physicists' participation, including presumably their early inventions, but Compton had to clear it with Conant. Until the arrangement was cleared and a new contract signed, Szilard would remain off the payroll. Compton reported Bush's response to Szilard in late March. There matters stood until early May, when Szilard, with restrained exasperation, proposed to proceed with filing patent applications. He asked that Groves designate someone to act as his legal advisor. The Army general supplied a Navy captain, Robert A. Lavender, who was attached to the OSRD in Washington, and Szilard met frequently with Lavender in the spring and early summer to discuss his claims. Somewhere along the way, Groves put Szilard under surveillance. The brigadier still harbored the incredible notion that Leo Szilard might be a German agent. The surveillance was already months old in mid-June when the MED security office suggested discontinuing it. Groves rejected the suggestion out of hand. The investigation of Z-Large should be continued despite the barrenness of the results. One letter or phone call once in 3 months would be sufficient for the passing of vital information, and until we know for certain that he is 100% reliable, we cannot entirely disregard this person. He apparently equated disagreement with disloyalty, and scaled the ratio of the two conditions directly. Anyone who caused him as much pain as Leo Szilard must be a spy. It followed that he ought to be watched. The surveillance of an innocent but eccentric man makes gumshoe comedy.
Szilard traveled to Washington on June 20, 1943, and in preparation for the visit, an Army counterintelligence agent reviewed his file. The surveillance reports indicate that subject is of Jewish extraction, has a fondness for delicacies, and frequently makes purchases in delicatessen stores, usually eats his breakfast in drugstores and other meals in restaurants, walks a great deal when he cannot secure a taxi, usually is shaved in a barber shop, speaks occasionally in a foreign tongue, and associates mostly with people of Jewish extraction.
He is inclined to be rather absent-minded and eccentric, and will start out a door, turn around and come back, go out on the street without his coat or hat, and frequently looks up and down the street as if he were watching for someone or did not know for sure where he wanted to go. Armed with these profundities, a Washington agent observed the subject arriving at the Wardman Park Hotel at 20:30 hours, 8:30 p.m., on June 20th, and composed a contemporary portrait. Age, 35 or 40 years. Height, 5'6". Weight, 165 pounds. Medium build. Florid complexion. Bushy brown hair combed straight back and inclined to be curly. Slight limp in right leg, causing droop in right shoulder and receding forehead. He was wearing a brown suit, brown shoes, white shirt, red tie, and no hat. Szilard worked the next morning at the Carnegie Institution with Captain Lavender. Wigner arrived at the Wardman Park for an overnight stay. Mr. Wigner is approximately 40 years of age, medium build, bald head, Jewish features, and was conservatively dressed. And the two Hungarians, both of them presumably with justice on their minds, went off for a tour of the Supreme Court. The cabbie said that they did not talk in a foreign tongue and there was nothing in their conversation to attract his attention. He said they more or less gave him the impression that they were on a lark. In the evening, they sat on a bench by the hotel tennis courts, where both pulled off their coats, rolled up their sleeves, and talked in a foreign language for some time.
Wigner checked out early in the morning. Szilard took a cab to the Navy Building at 17th and Constitution Avenue, entered the reception room, and told one of the ladies that he wished to see Commander Louis Strauss about personal business. He stated that he had an appointment. He also told the lady that he was a friend of Commander Strauss's and was interested in getting into a branch of the Navy.
The Naval Research Laboratory had continued to work on nuclear power for submarine propulsion independently of the Manhattan Project, and that institution may have been the one Szilard had in mind. Or he may have been practicing misdirection. Strauss took him to lunch at the Metropolitan Club and apparently discouraged him from transferring. Back at his hotel, he wired Gertrude Weiss that he expected to arrive at the King's Crown at 8:30 p.m., and left that afternoon for New York. Since he worked for Vannevar Bush, Lavender was hardly a disinterested consultant. When he met again with Szilard on July 14th, he informed the physicist that his documents failed to disclose an operable pile, meaning that, in his opinion, Szilard could not claim a patentable invention. 10 years after the end of the war, Szilard and Fermi won a joint patent for their invention of the nuclear reactor. Szilard realized then, if not before, that he needed private counsel, and asked that an attorney who could act in his behalf be cleared. The battle was almost decided. Szilard retreated to New York. He negotiated now not only with Lavender, but with Army Lieutenant Colonel John Lansdale Jr., Groves' chief of security. In an October 9th letter to Szilard, Groves summed up the blunt exchange over which the three men bargained. "You were assured by Lavender and Lansdale that as soon as you were able to convey full rights to any invention made prior to government employment, negotiations would be entered into with a view to acquisition by the government of any rights you may have and your re-employment on government contracts. I repeat this assurance. That is, Szilard could trade his patent rights, if any, for the privilege of working to beat the Germans to the bomb. Groves and Szilard arranged a temporary truce. The general may have imagined it was a surrender, at a meeting in Chicago on December 3rd. The army agreed to pay Szilard $15,416.60 to reimburse him for the 20 months when he worked unpaid and out-of-pocket at Columbia, and for lawyer's fees. The general had attempted several times to force Szilard to sign a document promising not to give any information of any kind relating to the project to any unauthorized person. Szilard had consistently agreed verbally to that restriction, and just as consistently refused, as a matter of honor, to sign. He meant to continue protesting, and on January 14, 1944, he began again with a 3-page letter to Vannevar Bush. He knew 15 people, he told Bush, who at one time or another felt so strongly about compartmentalization that they intended to reach the president. The central issue, as always, was freedom of scientific speech. Decisions are often clearly recognized as mistakes at the time when they are made by those who are competent to judge, but there is no mechanism by which their collective views would find expression or become a matter of record. In this letter, for the first time, Szilard emphasized a purpose to his urgency beyond beating the Germans to the bomb, that the bomb might be used and become grimly known.
If peace is organized before it has penetrated the public's mind that the potentialities of atomic bombs are a reality,
it will be impossible to have a peace that is based on reality. Making some allowances for the further development of the atomic bomb in the next few years, this weapon will be so powerful that there can be no peace if it is simultaneously in the possession of any two powers unless these two powers are bound by an indissoluble political union. It will hardly be possible to get political action along that line unless high-efficiency atomic bombs have actually been used in this war, and the fact of their destructive power has deeply penetrated the mind of the public. Which was the explanation Szilard now gave for challenging the army and DuPont? This, for me personally, is perhaps the main reason for being distressed by what I see happening around me. Bush insisted in return that all was well. I feel that the record, when this effort is over, he wrote Szilard, will show clearly that there has never at any time been any bar to the proper expression of opinion by scientists and professional men within their appropriate sphere of activity in this whole project. But he was willing to meet with Szilard, if that was what the physicist wanted. In February, preparing for that meeting, Szilard drafted 42 pages of notes. Much in these notes is specific and local. Here and there, basic issues are joined. Since invention is unpredictable, Szilard writes, the only thing we can do in order to play safe is to encourage sufficiently large groups of scientists to think along those lines and to give them all the basic facts which they need to be encouraged to such activity. This was not done in the past in the Manhattan Project, and it is not being done at present. He tracked the consequences of the government's policies of restriction. The attitude taken toward foreign-born scientists in the early stages of this work had far-reaching consequences, affecting the attitude of the American-born scientists. Once the general principle that authority and responsibility should be given to those who had the best knowledge and judgment is abandoned by discriminating against the foreign-born scientists, it is not possible to uphold this principle with respect to American-born scientists either. If authority is not given to the best men in the field, there does not seem to be any compelling reason to give it to the second-best men, and one may give it to the third or fourth or fifth-best men, whichever of them appears to be the most agreeable on purely subjective grounds. Wigner's early discouragement was an incalculable loss, Szilard thought. The fact that Fermi was excluded from centrifuge development work at Columbia visibly affected him, and he has, from that time on, shown a very marked attitude of being always ready to be of service, rather than considering it his duty to take the initiative. Finally, Szilard judged the Met Lab moribund, its services rejected and its spirits broken, and pronounced its epitaph. The scientists are annoyed, feel unhappy, and incapable of living up to their responsibility which this unexpected turn in the development of physics has thrown into their lap. As a consequence of this, the morale has suffered to the point where it almost amounts to a loss of faith. The scientists shrug their shoulders and go through the motions of performing their duty. They no longer consider the overall success of this work as their responsibility. In the Chicago Project, the morale of the scientists could almost be plotted in a graph by counting the number of lights burning after dinner in the offices in Eckert Hall. At present, the lights are out. But Leo Szilard was not yet done with protest. Enrico Fermi took the initiative at least once during the war, perhaps influenced by the enthusiasm he found at Los Alamos for weapons making. He proposed at the time of the April 1943 conference, privately to Robert Oppenheimer, it appears, that radioactive fission products bred in a chain-reacting pile might be used to poison the German food supply. The possibility of using radioactive material bred in a nuclear reactor as a weapon of war had been mentioned by Arthur Compton's National Academy of Sciences Committee in 1941. German development of such a weapon began worrying the scientists at the Met Lab late in 1942, on the assumption that Germany might be a year or more ahead of the United States in pile development. If CP-1 went critical in December 1942, they argued, the Germans might have had time by then to run a pile long enough to create fiercely radioactive isotopes that could be mixed with dust or liquid to make radioactive, but not fissionable, bombs. Germany might then logically attempt preemptively to attack the Met Lab, if not American cities. German development of radioactive warfare, another vision in a dark mirror, seemed to the leaders of the Manhattan Project to require countering by examination into parallel U.S. development. The S-1 committee gave such assignment to a subcommittee consisting of James Bryan Conant as chairman and Arthur Compton and Harold Urey as members. That subcommittee went to work sometime before May 1943, probably before February. Fermi would have known of the Met Lab discussions. His proposal to Oppenheimer at the April conference was different from those essentially defensive concerns, however, and clearly offensive in intent. He may well have been motivated in part by his scientific conservatism, may have asked himself what recourse was open to the United States if a fast fission bomb proved impossible. It could not be demonstrated by experiment for at least 2 years, and have found the answer in the formidable neutron flux of CP-1 and its intended successors. Oppenheimer swore Fermi to intimate secrecy within the larger secrecy of the Manhattan Project. When the Italian laureate returned to Chicago, he went quietly to work. In May, Oppenheimer traveled to Washington. Among other duties, he reported Fermi's ideas to Groves and learned of the Conant subcommittee. Back at Los Alamos on May 25th, he wrote Fermi a warm letter reporting what he had found. He attributed the subcommittee assignment to a request from the Army Chief of Staff, George Marshall, although it seems far likelier that the study originated within the Manhattan Project. I, therefore, with Groves's knowledge and approval, discussed with Conant the application, that is, poisoning German food supplies, which seemed to us so promising. Oppenheimer had also discussed Fermi's idea with Edward Teller, the isotope the men identified that appears to offer the highest promise was strontium, probably strontium-90, which the human body takes up in place of calcium and deposits dangerously and irretrievably in bone. Teller thought that separating the strontium from other pile products is not a very major problem. Oppenheimer wanted to delay the work until the latest safe date, he told Fermi further, so that they would have a much better chance of keeping your plan quiet. He did not even want to include Compton in any immediate discussion. Summarizing, he wrote, in part, I should recommend delay if that is possible. In this connection, I think that we should not attempt a plan unless we can poison food sufficient to kill 500,000 men, since There is no doubt that the actual number affected will, because of non-uniform distribution, be much smaller than this. There is no better evidence anywhere in the record of the increasing bloody-mindedness of the Second World War than that Robert Oppenheimer, a man who professed at various times in his life to be dedicated to ahimsa, the Sanskrit word that means doing no harm or hurt, he explains, could write with enthusiasm of preparations for the mass poisoning of as many as 500,000 human beings. Mid-1943 was, in any case, a season of great apprehension among the atomic scientists, who saw Nazi Germany beginning to lose the war and sensed that country's desperation. The Manhattan Project expected to produce atomic bombs by early 1945. If Germany had begun fission research in 1939 at similar scale, it should have bombs nearly in hand. Hans Bethe and Edward Teller wrote Oppenheimer in a memorandum on August 21st, "Recent reports, both through the newspapers and through Secret Service, have given indications that the Germans may be in possession of a powerful new weapon, which is expected to be ready between November and January. There seems to be a considerable probability that this new weapon is tube alloy, that is, uranium. It is not necessary to describe the probable consequences which would result if this proves to be the case. It is possible that the Germans will have, by the end of this year, enough material accumulated to make a large number of gadgets, which they will release at the same time on England, Russia, and this country. In this case, there would be little hope for any counteraction. However, it is also possible that they will have a production, let us say, of 2 gadgets a month. This would place particularly Britain in an extremely serious position. But there would be hope for counteraction from our side before the war is lost, provided our own tube alloy program is drastically accelerated in the next few weeks." The memorandum goes on to criticize the handling of production entirely by large companies. The Hungarian Threnody, Szilard, and Wigner also sounded, and to propose a crash program directed by Urey and Fermi to build heavy water piles. Nothing seems to have come of the Bethe-Teller proposal. Hitler's secret weapons proved to be the V-1 and V-2 rockets then in development at Peenemünde, the first of which crossed the English coast on June 13, 1944. But it captures the mid-war mood. Less worrisome was radioactive dusting. Conant's subcommittee considered the possibilities and concluded that they were rather remote. Conant emphasized that he thought it extremely unlikely that a radioactive weapon will be used against the U.S., and unlikely the weapon will be used at all. Groves eventually proposed to George Marshall that a handful of officers be trained in the use of Geiger counters and sent to England to observe. Preparing for the Normandy invasion, Marshall approved. It was easier for Americans guarded by the wide moat of the Atlantic than for the British to dismiss the possibility of radioactive attack. Sir John Anderson, Chancellor of the Exchequer, a scientist and the member of Churchill's cabinet responsible for the tube alloy program, discussed the question with Conant at lunch at the Cosmos Club in Washington in August 1943. He was concerned particularly about German heavy water production, because British scientists believed they had found a way to separate light from heavy water at 5 times the efficiency of existing processes, and feared their German counterparts might have made the same discovery. Heavy water would certainly work to moderate a chain-reacting pile, and such a machine might be used to breed radioactive isotopes for dusting London. The British, therefore, kept closer watch on the high-concentration plant at Vemork in Norway. It had not been damaged beyond repair. To the contrary, intelligence sources reported that summer, it had begun production again in April. German scientists had shipped heavy water from laboratory stocks in Germany to refill the various cells and speed restoration of the cascade. When Niels Bohr escaped from Stockholm to Scotland on October 6, 1943, he carried with him Werner Heisenberg's drawing of an experimental heavy water reactor. Bohr met more than once in London that autumn with Sir John Anderson. Anderson matched up Bohr's information with the Conant subcommittee's radioactive warfare study and the Norwegian Underground's news of Vemork's renewed production, and concluded that the plant once again urgently required attack. The Nazis had significantly increased security at Vemork, which ruled out another commando raid. After British and American representatives discussed the problem in Washington, George Marshall authorized precision bombing. The American 8th Air Force B-17s climbed northeast from British bases before dawn on the morning of November 16th. To minimize Norwegian casualties, the aircraft were scheduled to drop their bombs during the Norsk Hydro lunch period between 11:30 a.m. and noon. No German fighters came up from the defensive airfields of western Norway to delay them, and they elected to circle over the North Sea to kill time before penetrating the Scandinavian peninsula. That alerted German flak, which took a limited toll as the bombers crossed the coast. 140 got through to Vemork and released more than 700 500-pound bombs. None hit the aiming point, but four destroyed the power station and two damaged the electrolysis unit that supplied hydrogen to the high-concentration plant, effectively shutting it down. Abraham Isau of the Reich Research Council decided then to rebuild in Germany. To expedite construction, the council planned to dismantle the Vemork plant and remove it to the Reich. The Norwegian Underground reported that decision to London. Anderson was less concerned with the plant itself, Germany had only limited hydroelectricity to divert to its operation, than with the heavy water preserved in its cascade. British intelligence asked the Norwegians to keep watch. Word came by way of clandestine shortwave radio from the Rjukan area on February 9, 1944, that the heavy water would be transported under guard to Germany within a week or two. Not enough warning to prepare and drop in a squad of saboteurs. Knut Haukelid, who had spent the past year living on the land and organizing future military operations, was the only trained commando in the area, except for the radio operator. He would have to destroy the heavy water alone, with whatever amateur help he could assemble. Haukelid slipped into Rjukan at night and met secretly with the new chief engineer at Vemork, Alf Larsen. Larsen agreed to help, and they discussed possible operations. The heavy water, of enrichments varying from 97.6 down to 1.1%, would be transferred to some 39 drums labeled potash lye. "A one-man attack on Vemork," writes Haukelid, "I consider out of the question. The only practical possibility, therefore, was to try to carry out an attack on the transport in one way or another." He and Larsen, joined later by the Vemork transport engineer, considered the various stages of the journey. The drums of water would go by train from Rjukan to the head of Lake Tinsjo. From there, the cars would be run onto a rail ferry to travel the length of the lake, proceeding beyond Tinsjo again by train to the port, where they would be loaded aboard a ship bound for Germany. Blowing up the trains would be difficult and bloody, since they would be crowded with Norwegian passengers. Haukelid had finally decided to attempt to sink the ferry, which also carries passengers, into the 1,300-foot lake. The transport engineer agreed to arrange to dispatch the heavy water on a Sunday morning, when the ferry was usually less crowded. Sabotaging the boat would almost certainly mean the deaths of some of the shipment's German guards, which would call down heavy reprisals in the Tinsjo area against the Norwegian population. Haukelid radioed London for permission, emphasizing that his engineer compatriots had questioned if the results were worth the reprisals. "The fact that the Germans were using heavy water for atomic experiments, and that an atomic explosion might possibly be brought about, was the thing we now talked of openly. At Rjukan they doubted very much whether the Germans had come in sight of a solution. They also doubted whether an explosion of the kind could be brought about at all."